This is Joel Spolsky, the host of the Stack Overflow podcast.
We should just do a podcast takeover. It would be cool.
This is the Stack Overflow podcast, episode number John Skeet, recorded John's Day, Skeetuary 15th, 2018, at Stack Overflow headquarters in New York City, where 8 million people live in peace and enjoy the benefits of democracy. And home to Staten Island, the ancestral birthplace of Christina Aguilera, Steven Seagal, and Michael the Situation Sorrentino. But you probably could have guessed all that. Today's podcast is brought to you by the World Curling Association. Be a part of the sports sensation that's literally sweeping the nation. Join the WCA and learn the only sport that lets you marry your love of throwing rocks at stuff with your love of housekeeping. Remember, let he who is without a broom cast the first stone. Mean, that was mean. This week, we're here with our usual crew. We have news editor Ilana Itzaki.
Hello.
Producer Jess Pardue.
Hiya.
And joining us this week in the studio, we have inclusion manager and senior people partner Casey Ashenhurst.
Hey.
An executive cat wrangler and CEO trainer, Cassie Montrose.
Hello.
And a man that truly needs no introduction for our audience. John Skeet is, as of last month, the first and so far only person ever to hit 1 million rep on Stack Overflow, a senior software developer at Google, world-renowned expert in Java and C#, the undisputed titan of time zone coding, father of three boys, Methodist preacher, outspoken feminist blogger, and I learned just yesterday, a year younger than me, which helped me realize that my life has no meaning.
Hey.
Joel Spolsky is in Pyeongchang this week, hoping to bring home the gold in the women's figure skating pair short program, which makes me your host, Jay Hanlon, EVP of Culture and Experience, and the official body double for Peter Taufatofua, the Tongan Olympic flag bearer. Welcome back, everyone.
Hello, thanks for having us.
How is everybody?
Good.
Hi.
Good.
Yeah. That's especially funny because I know what Peter Taufatofua looks like.
Yeah.
I don't. So if that's the case, then I don't understand why it's so funny.
Wait, what does he look like?
He's ripped.
I'll sit down.
The way you said that was the meanest thing I've ever heard.
He's very, like, oiled.
He is, yeah, he's,
that's how Jay comes to work every day.
That may not be, you know, all the time.
Just when he is flag bearing?
Yes. So the best part, so he got famous, I guess, in the Summer Olympics. He's a Taekwondo star of some sort, and he came out shirtless in a, I guess, traditional Tongan attire of some sort with the flag, oiled up, and he's a striking human figure. And then he decided that people liked that, and it was pretty cool. So he wanted to come to the Winter Olympics. So he lost 30 pounds and learned to cross-country ski. So he could qualify for the Tongan cross-country ski team and be this flag bearer again.
Do they have a really good cross-country ski team? Did he have to?
What I can tell you is abs still look fantastic.
Oh, okay.
I know nothing about their cross-country ski capabilities. So the other thing I learned this week is, do you know it's Pyeongchang and NBC just can't be bothered to say it the way they say it in their native country?
Wait, what?
How do we say it?
Everyone says Pyeongchang because it's spelled that way in English, but it's Pyeongchang.
That doesn't surprise me in the least.
Yeah.
Anyway. So welcome, John.
Thank you.
You are a longtime friend of the company, as most folks know, but also a friend of the podcast. You're here, I want to say, was it 2011?
Jess knows the exact numbers.
I think it was May 5th, 2011.
Is anyone else surprised John has not been counting the days since then?
I thought you were a time zone expert.
Well, it was, so it was May the 5th, but that was in London. So, you know.
Oh.
But I think it was about 3 p.m., so it would still have been, you know, 10 a.m. here.
What year is it in London right now?
Well, before Brexit, it's 2018, and next year we go back to, you know, 1960, 1970, so, you know, who knows?
Well, here it's about 1955 right now, so, you know, we're in really good company.
I was told there'd be no talk of geopolitics or depressing things at this podcast.
Sorry, that's my one.
It is my understanding, John, that since you've arrived in New York, you have had some experiences that perhaps they were less than perfect.
Uh-huh.
And you might even have a John Skeet rant process. Is this true?
So in general, I have had a lovely time so far. It's been wonderful. Everyone's been extremely hospitable. Particular shout out to the park ranger at Hamilton Grange, who was just extraordinarily friendly. But yeah, I have three things to rant about at the moment. So firstly,
nice.
Our apartment's heating, which I gather is just a New York thing that, you know, having the heat on full blast for the whole building just happens, and we open windows rather than saying, it's February, we shouldn't need to have heating on and windows open, you know, just having some kind of control of heating would be good. I would have thought in a fairly advanced city like New York, that would be a thing, but
they have control. It's on, and sometimes it's not on.
Okay, yeah. We seem to have a sort of sweepstake every time when we go home to the apartment. It's like, is it going to be roasting hot or just kind of normal?
Is it an older building?
Is there really an elevator? Know.
There is an elevator.
Hmm.
But just the one.
How high are the ceilings?
Are we just asking random building questions?
No, I wanted to know. I wanted to know if it was like a radiator situation, because in that case, I feel your pain. Yeah. I have the windows open and the air conditioning on at my house sometimes.
Yeah, the host suggested that we put the air conditioning on. And coming from the UK where we hardly ever have, I have air conditioning in my home office shed, and I feel kind of bad about having that. But I only would put that on in June when it's like 30 very, very occasionally in the UK. The idea of having air conditioning on and the windows open in February in New York just blows my mind.
Yeah.
So that was the first thing. The second thing I will come back to in a sec of Applebee's. And the third was just theatre etiquette. We were at Dear Evan Hansen yesterday afternoon, which is an awesome, awesome show, as are Once on This Island and Avenue Q, which we also saw this week.
Excellent.
We've had a fantastic time. We told the boys, so I have three boys. The oldest is 14 and the twins are 11. And we weren't sure whether there might be eyebrows raised at them coming to Avenue Q. So they were told that, you know,
right?
As far as, yeah, yeah. Somewhat, yeah. So we said, if anyone asks you, you're 13, okay? and that would make our eldest sort of, well, you can say you're 15. You could get away with that. The twins could get away with 13. But of course, no one raised their eyebrows at all. But it was hilariously funny, especially watching the younger of the twins being the puppets having sex on stage. He didn't know whether to look and laugh or sort of bury his head in his hands. It was quite hilarious.
Yeah, I can imagine that would be as hilarious as a parent as like the show is hilarious.
My mother would have covered my eyes. She well, still does.
We've been listening to the soundtrack for a few months now. So they knew kind of what was going to happen, but I hadn't actually seen what that part of the show would be like. And it's pretty full on. Yeah. Let's just say there's variety in there. Anyway, so Dear Evan Hansen, yesterday, again, we've been looking forward to for a while, and there's a song called Words Fail, which is, you know, very emotional, angsty, all kinds of amazing, and the couple in front of my wife decided that that's the time. They would have a little chat, an occasional giggle, like, no, this is just wrong. They had, I think, a couple of cups of wine, but just no. But that was after we'd had lunch at Applebee's, and we don't have Applebee's in the UK, I don't think. We were aiming for Ellen Stardust Diner that has had a huge queue every time we've been outside there. So that was our hope. Seeing the queue, knowing we didn't have much time, okay, we'll go to Applebee's. We can see it's there. I'm sure it won't take too long. And four of our meals did arrive pretty quickly. And the fifth was about 20, 25 minutes later. And the manager came and was very apologetic and said, okay, I've taken that off your bill and I've given you a 15% discount on the rest of the bill. It's like, this is good, okay. Right, we'll pay. And I swipe my credit card into they have sort of payment at the table machine things. And
of course they do.
It didn't ask me for a signature. So I was sort of, that's a little odd. Or a tip. I thought, okay, maybe if they've taken a discount off, they would just not prompt you for a tip for etiquette reasons or something. And it was saying, okay, you now have nothing to pay. So I thought, okay. And we started to leave. And then one of the members of the wait staff ran after me saying, you haven't paid. It's like, I'm sure I did. Okay, so I went back, they tried to pull up the bill, and now various other orders have been added to the same bill. So we couldn't, there were two or three of them trying to get actually our order, but without the meal that had been taken off and maybe with the discount. And I ended up just saying, right, just have $100, we've got to go, because we were getting late for Dear Evan Hansen at this point. So it was a case of system fail. Every individual that I dealt with was doing the absolute best they could. And I felt really sorry for them because, you know, they're in the customer service business. They knew that I was unhappy, but there was nothing that they could do to make me happy. So shout out to them. They were doing absolutely the best they could, but they were fighting against a system that was really not helping them.
Was it a computer system?
See, as native New Yorkers, we eat at Applebee's pretty much every day, and we've really optimized our way through these systems. When people ask me what was John Skeet like in person, all I'm going to say is the main thing we talked about is that when he got to New York, the first place he went was Applebee's. And I'm just going to leave it at that and walk away. And that will be your New York legacy, John. So the moral of the story is you're going to stick with like the Olive Garden next time. Is that?
So I feel Chili's. That would make more sense if I knew anything about the Olive Garden.
Okay. I'd pass on that one too, I think.
Okay. Okay.
Jay, you forget I'm from the Midwest, so don't insult the food of my people.
So where Midwest is sort of to the east of the center of the country, right?
The middle part. Yeah, I'm from Ohio.
Yeah. I've always been confused about American geography where Midwest. I would have expected the Midwest to be like near the west.
It is not in the western half.
No.
Yeah, I would agree. No. You think center of the west half maybe would be where you'd stick it? That's Pacific something or geography's not.
There's the Pacific Northwest, the plains. The Midwest is really big.
What's
that's
in the plains
other part.
States? Like Buffalo?
I don't know. No, like South Dakota.
Okay,
and
sure.
Stuff like that.
Sure.
I don't know. I think of those as like.
So what counts plains. As the flyover states?
All of them.
Nebraska. Between,
yeah, that's what snobby New Yorkers and Californians call everything else.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Really good book. That. The View from Flyover Country, Sarah Kendzior.
Oh, I heard that's
very,
great.
Very, very good. Yeah,
I haven't read it. I heard
a
it's
big
awesome.
Sarah Kendzior fan.
So let's talk about why John's here. So John Skeet, for those of you listening who don't know who John Skeet is, I'm just kidding. You all know who John Skeet is. John recently hit a million reputation on the site. Some awesome stats. Our colleague, data scientist, Dr. Julia Silge, recently put up a great blog post you can check out. Some of the numbers around John, he's had 34,102 answers and 50 questions. Remember, kids, even John Skeet asks questions sometimes. 3 million people have landed on a John Skeet question. I'm going to come back to that one in a second because I think that tells a story that's a little bit different than the game. 22% of the users that asked a question that John Skeet answered had an account that was less than a month old. So what are we getting at there? An enormous number of these people are new. And I think there's something that can be very infuriating about new people asking questions mm-hmm. who haven't thought about how to ask a question. But there's something really, there's something magical. And one of the things I've been thinking about on the site a lot, but in reference to this is I always think about those people reached and when you get beyond the game and when you think about sort of what's happening, what are those hits? And it's this hurdle clearing. It's this idea of a little girl who's trying to build something and has hit some spot. Well, not that little. All right. A young woman, more likely, who's trying to build something and hit a spot she can't get past and she doesn't know what to do next. And when somebody searches and that kid finds the answer and it lets them go on and it lets them build something awesome, what's cool is it's not that they wrote this dumb little program they were working on. And if it were me, it would just say J is cool. And then if you put the semicolon, it goes over and over. Anyway, forget it. Never mind. I never got past basic. It's not important right now. But the point is for a lot of these people, I think when that first project gets done, they find the thing they love to do. And whether that's right. as a hobby or a job. The big numbers are amazing, but it's sort of, you have to take it back to sort of one person, I think. And I think it's super amazing. And so we did a little bit of math. I'm not really good at the maths. I'm trying to say math. See, John's here and he keeps asking why we all talk so funny. And so I'm trying to say maths to make him feel at home.
Which is what his degree is in, not in, math. Math.
In the maths, yes. Yeah. The maths.
Although it's a Bachelor of Arts for reasons. I don't know why.
You
don't
a Bachelor of Arts is a degree.
Yeah.
We have
I was
that.
Still technically correct.
But you guys don't call it Bachelors of Arts over there or anything?
No, just
okay.
Bachelor of
okay.
Arts.
Okay. Okay. So,
are you just saying math is an artistic? Is that your point?
Well, it sort of feels like I think there is Bachelor of Maths.
There's Bachelor
in
of Science.
Some, yeah. So I think in some places.
It's a BS degree.
You would get, in some places, you can get a B math. And you can definitely get an M math, but I got my kind of free MA. So bizarre thing about if you go to Oxford or Cambridge, you do your bachelor's degree, and then a year later they say, oh, just have a master's for free.
What?
Yeah, huh. You get a master's just, as it happens, I did.
I'm really mad right now.
Wait, where's Cambridge? Because I have the bachelor's. Can I just go there and get the master's? Is that a, no? It does. Okay.
That's kind of be from Oxford or Cambridge.
That seems very elitist to me.
Yeah. So I actually did a fourth year in computer science, which was a diploma in computer science, but effectively a master's equivalent. Although when I went for a job interview to one place where they were saying, would you like to come and learn this language that's only used by this company? I was already thinking this doesn't sound great for my career. Yeah. And the person said, oh, I see you have a diploma in computer science. Is that what you get if you fail your MA? Like, no, actually. It was the oldest taught computer science course in the world.
What do you mean you did your fourth year computer science? Did you only go to school for 3 years?
Yeah. Yeah. So 3 years of math's degree.
I continued to be mad.
So some people did 4 years of maths, can do a part four at Cambridge, which I don't know whether that counts as a separate MA or something. But for those of us who had enough of maths to 3 years, that's fine.
Degrees are different in the UK than they are in the US. That's what I
sounds like they're
from.
Better, not just different.
Well, and we don't have the whole major minor thing. Maths was all I did, except that actually I spent most of my time doing theatre stuff instead.
And you get a gap year. This is like
hardly anyone doing maths did, at least, you know, back in 25 years ago when I did my degree, hardly any mathematicians did gap years. Because you sort of forget all your A-level, sort of 17, 18-year-old maths, kind of forget in a gap year.
Everything I learned about the schooling system in the UK, I learned from Harry Potter.
It's all true. Absolutely. And the staircases, it's all
Were good. You head boy?
I was deputy school captain.
Oh, my, that sounds even better.
But I only learned about it when I showed up the first day of my final year at school. Someone said, "You're deputy school captain." I was like, what? Because normally it's the sports folks get school captain.
So if the sports captain dies, you become the captain.
Well, it just meant that I did all the prefects, like rotas and things. So yeah, I felt like I was a notional academic.
So you are the top rated user on Stack Overflow, and you were the prefect at school. That's like being the prom king.
Very much not prom king.
Okay.
Although we don't have proms
like
anyway.
Opposite of prom king.
Wait, the UK doesn't have prom?
No. I think some schools now have sort of taken on the US system of proms a bit, but
what about Sadie Hawkins? I didn't have a Do you know what Sadie Hawkins is?
I feel I should, but no.
Where the girls are supposed to ask the boys.
So February 29th is in the UK when
I thought that was
women
an
are
Irish
meant
thing.
I haven't heard of it as particularly Irish, but
well, the US movie about it.
Okay.
Wait, what
is February 29th?
Yeah, I don't know what we're talking about yet.
Oh, so sorry. Women
down
can propose
the patriarchy
to men.
Where, yeah. Exactly. So in a world where
very heteronormative
so
world.
365 times 4 days out of every 4 years, obviously the men ask the women proposing, and one day out of every 4 years is, you know, it's okay for the women to ask.
Oh, on leap
so you
day.
Guys,
yeah.
We got a leap year day.
Yeah.
That's what we got.
So, interesting question. In the Jewish calendar, where there's a whole leap month, does the same thing happen but for longer?
Oh, Adar Bet.
You sounded so sad about the month.
No, because I didn't think about that, but I know what you're saying.
Right.
And I don't know.
I mean, the whole concept, yes.
I mean, again, I want to bring it back to, I thought you were a time expert.
So the one question I had on the Jewish Stack Exchange was around leap months in the Hebrew calendar system because of I was doing research for Noda Time. So what happens when you add a year to, were you saying it's Adar or Adar? I've never known how to pronounce it because you only see it as text.
Adar.
So the second Adar, if you add a year to that, where do you end up? Is it the same day in the first Adar?
Brigadoon. You wind up at Brigadoon, I believe, consistently.
And you can end up with weird, if birthdays are celebrated in the way that I think they are, then you can end up with weird things where, Jay, I may be younger than you, but have been born before you, or weird stuff because of what happens when you add years.
Yeah, that's there's another play about, wow, we're really getting good play. Pirates of Penzance. Is it because he was born on leap day, so he's only 7, so he can't be the pirate captain, even though he's really 40, or my math was really
there
bad
was
there.
There was some, I think, something
true.
In either Canada or Sweden, and those shouldn't be two countries easily mistaken, but there was someone who the other day was unable to get their driving license because the computer thought they were
I saw that
instead of 24.
Yeah.
I can't
no,
remember.
Can't figure it out, even though it's been a problem since Gilbert and Sullivan. He is a little boy of 5.
That's it. Yep. Right. Yep.
This is your second reference to pirates on our podcast.
No, really?
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised it's only 2.
I don't even love that play. All right. So
I just feel absolutely duty bound to say they're all about duty.
They
Who
are
else
all.
Loves
Which
West Wing?
More of a, exactly yes, more of a West Wing reference. I've sung the Mikado, but I haven't been to see any GNS, and I really feel I should. So I've probably seen more GNS via the West Wing than anything else.
Oh, I definitely have.
My grandfather did a lot of Gilbert and Sullivan. He was like part of the Gilbert and Sullivan players something at the University of Chicago. So I saw a lot of Gilbert and Sullivan when I was young.
This is the best Broadway podcast on the web, my friends. So let's go back to embarrassing John a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
What I alluded to earlier is someone has landed on one of John Skeet's answers 227.3 million times.
So, just to clarify, that's not one person having landed on it 227 million times.
To be perfectly honest, I can't be sure. But it seems unlikely. It is probably mostly different people. And just trying to put that in perspective is if we assume everybody, each time someone found an answer that John posted, and let's say John's answers are always right, but sometimes they were looking for something else, even if we assume that only half the time they found it was the right question they landed on. And let's say it saves them 30 minutes each time because they clear some coding hurdle. I did some math. Again, I'm not great at it, but that's 56.8 million hours. If we break it into 8-hour workdays, that's 7.1 million 8-hour workdays saved, which is 323,000 mythical person months saved, which if you really want to break into a long period of time, that is 27,000 years of full-time programming with no sick days, no holidays, no paid time off because you probably work at some sweatshop in an open plan environment, mean bosses, don't understand anything. And to put that in perspective, it's tricky to, if you translate sort of that time into length, it's 4 CVS receipts here in New York City. I've been to CVS, but that's about what it comes out to. And I think my favorite, you know, we like to joke a lot, but I think my favorite way to put John Skeet's accomplishments in sort of a serious perspective is, of course, the John Skeet Chuck Norris page on Metastack Overflow.
I love this page.
If you haven't checked it out, you can just Google John Skeet Chuck Norris, and you'll land exactly where you'd expect to. And I want to pull up many of these are years old, but they are just, if you want to understand John Skeet, I will share a few of my favorites with you. These are John Skeet facts presented by our meta audience, by people who I think we can safely say truly understand him. God didn't really create the world in 6 days because John Skeet optimized it to 1. John Skeet can recite pi backwards. Anonymous methods and anonymous types are really all called John Skeet. They just don't like to boast. John Skeet coded his last project entirely in Microsoft Paint just for the challenge. When John Skeet points to null, null quakes in fear. Google is really just John Skeet behind a proxy. John Skeet can throw an exception farther than anyone else and in far less time. The only time John Skeet was wrong was when he thought he had made a mistake. And my personal favorite, John Skeet does not run his programs. He just whispers, better run. And they run. Check out John Skeet Chuck Norris on Google. It will take you to a veritable treasure trove of such things. But for now, that brings us to the most democratic fake part of our program. As our loyal listeners know, we are preparing a constitution for Stack Overflow, and each week we bring you, our loyal listeners, a proposal, and you decide on whether that proposal does or does not become part of our official constitution. Last week's proposal was eggnog, where pro was, sure, that's a thing you could drink, and con was, that's gross, and you're gross for suggesting it. And here, with the results from last week, is new Senator Ilana Yatsaki.
People love eggnog.
Wow.
They really, really do.
Gross.
We had 86% pro.
Holy.
Yeah.
Gross.
Huh. Mm-hmm. Although, when I tasted it, it wasn't so bad.
You know.
And David made me an eggnog latte, and it was nice.
You just gotta sip it slowly and get the alcohol ratio right.
Oh, see?
I have to agree. Gross. It sounded disgusting. I was ranting about how terrible it was. Then you taste it, and you're like, that's pretty good. I ordered that at Starbucks. It was pretty delicious.
Mm. I was drinking it during that podcast recording, and I was just like,
I like it with ice.
An iced eggnog.
Super gross.
No, it just like makes it not so like thick.
Like pudding? It's like pudding.
Our podcast audience cannot see the face you're making, but I assure you, loyal listeners, it was delightful. Simply delightful.
We can have videos, right?
Yes.
So our winner for this constitution question is Akash Verma at the Utopian Ho. Bro, what's not to love? Egg, protein, milk, vitamins, cream, essential fat, sugar, duh. Taste yummy. Nah, drink it anyway. It keeps you warm. Still nah? Holiday mood? No worries. Go tipsy. Add whiskey.
Love it. It's like an old-timey ad you'd see like in cereal on the highway, you know, when they have like those. Excellent. And we'll be sending a sticker, right?
Yeah.
Normally at this point, we would introduce a new constitutional proposal for discussion, debate, and ultimate vote to see if perhaps it might be added to the Constitution. But as we have John Skeet, the master of everything, here with us today, we will instead allow him to simply issue a constitutional decree. And it will be so. John, take it away.
Okay, well, as Jay has had to try that three times, I will actually... I will go ahead and issue a decree, but then I also have a proposal that people could vote on as we're sort of talking Broadway stuff. So the decree is, after you add a comment in your code, there's normally a symbol, whether it's double slash or, you know, slash sure. star or hash or whatever it is, sorry, pound. After that, you know, it's optional as to whether you have a space after the symbols, normally. But no, in the Constitution, it should say there will be a space and then you will write a full proper sentence, you know, with a capital letter to start the sentence to explain yourself and your code. None of this just putting the symbols and then immediately typing without a capital letter or anything.
Sorry, so let me just make sure I understand the decree, since we will all be legally bound by it heretofore and thereafter. How am I doing? Okay, so you're saying the code comment must start like a proper sentence with a capital.
Yeah.
It must be in sentence form. Is that what you're also grammatically...
It can be a fragment instead, but still, just it looks wrong without the capital letter. Unless it's a variable name or something, some other identifier that, you know, if you're saying public would be invalid here or something like that, then... that would naturally start in lowercase.
I am 100% with you on capitalization. I think E.E. Cummings was a literary war criminal, as far as I'm concerned.
Is it a capital crime?
Yeah, okay. But when you said the space at the end, is that like after...
No, space at the start. Sorry, after the symbols. So you don't just write slash slash comment. You write slash slash space comment.
I see, like you would after an asterisk if you were making a markdown list.
Yeah, absolutely.
I see. Okay, yeah. Okay.
I'm for anything that helps with readability.
Exactly, exactly. Anything. It just looks wrong otherwise.
Well, you've heard it, ladies and gentlemen. I would normally suggest you go vote, but there is no point.
Because we have the thing to vote on.
The next part. I spoke too soon.
Okay.
Don't vote on that, because that's just the way things are now.
Right.
And if you don't like it, you can move to not England, because England and here, we're all set on this, but you could, I don't know where, you could go somewhere else. I hear there are other countries. John, what are we going to vote on?
So, in Hamilton, when King George is singing, and he says, everybody, is that an invitation for the audience to sing along with the next little bit?
I feel like there's an embarrassing personal story that might be prompting this question.
Not yet, but I'm seeing it again in July, so okay. There could be then.
Okay.
But it feels like there are three answers, and I did tweet this question a long time ago, but I'm more interested in the Stack Overflow audience's suggestions here. So maybe it's no, thou shalt not sing in the theatre, or yes, it's okay everywhere, or yes, it's okay, but only if you're seeing it in London, where we are King George's subjects. So when he's saying everybody, he's saying it to his subjects, and we should sing along.
Hmm. I see. So perhaps in London, it's actually a royal decree of some sort.
Exactly.
And when someone royal says something in London, you just have to do it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, yeah. Queen thing.
And any excuse to actually sing along to Hamilton.
Yes.
So we'll write it as everyone pro. That means you do sing along. There'll be a caveat of pro, but only if you're an English subject. And then con, don't sing because you are not.
I don't want to
Broadway material.
I don't want to be a stickler, but our parliamentary procedure does not allow for a three-option vote. I'm afraid we're going to have to break it into a binary for the audience. I think we should exclude the English question, perhaps, just because it's a small subset of our listening audience, those in England, and say, what's the law, though? Is the law you must sing or you might may not sing? The law would be...
Well, it wouldn't just be in England. It would be anywhere in Her Majesty's domain, which is a lot more than England, correct?
Certainly was back in King George's time. Yeah. We had an empire then.
Yeah, now it's like the sun. The sun sets kind of frequently there, you know.
I don't know. I feel like she's still the queen of other places.
Like Wales?
No, like Canada and Australia.
Yeah, there's still the whole Commonwealth thing.
Yeah.
The Commonwealth Games. That's like a thing that I learned about when I was in New Zealand, because it's like extra Olympics.
Does Katniss Everdeen usually win? I'm confused.
No, it's like a games similar to like the Olympics, except for it's just the Commonwealth countries.
I feel like it's my own fault, but now I'm super disappointed. I thought we were going in a different direction with this.
But okay. We'll just say pro, yes, you can sing along when he says everyone, and con, no, you are not Lin-Manuel Miranda, honey, so don't do it.
Vote your conscience, friends. Which brings us, if I am not mistaken, to our developer story. And normally at this point in the program, we have a talented developer on and we ask them to tell us a little bit of the story of their development career And they start from when they first, I always like to ask what first got someone excited about coding, and then they give us a little arc of their career. But we all have jobs to do, and we do not have many years to hear everything John has done. And so instead, we asked John what aspect of his work, his efforts, he would like to focus on. And John was super excited to talk about his work on diversity and inclusion initiatives and his thinking and writing on it in the tech space. And so I'm going to flip it over to my friends to chat a little bit about that.
Thanks, Jay.
You're welcome.
Well, I have a question. Since you're the king of Stack Overflow, right? That's the same as having all the rep?
Or the president, because it was voted on.
Okay. So the president of the site. So Stack Overflow, we know, is powered in part by a gamification system. Mm-hmm. You just hit 1 million rep on Stack Overflow. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
And thank you for your hard work. But there's research out there that says that gamification and adding competition tends to skew to be more appealing and motivated to men. So if you were starting Stack Overflow over again, what would you do differently to appeal to a more diverse group of developers?
I probably do some research to find out what appeals to a more diverse group of developers. So Jay mentioned my work in this area, which is basically nothing. I kind of say, this sucks, and write a little bit more than that, but it's pretty much frustration more than concerted effort with lots of research behind it and things. But I know a lot of research has been done, and even where there isn't research so much, there are communities I'm aware of, but I'm not a part of, which do better. And in fact, I was talking to someone at a conference recently about ML, and I know nothing about ML, pretty much. I went to like 4 sessions at 2 conferences in the space of 2 weeks, and the sum total of what I know was from those sessions, all given by women, by the way. And this woman said that in the ML space, the diversity is much better, certainly in terms of gender balance. I don't know about other aspects of diversity. So maybe there are things that we could learn from there. What is it about ML? Is it something inherent in the subject matter? Is it in the way that the tooling has been exposed? Is it in education? But yeah, where can we learn from what other communities are doing well?
That makes sense.
I would think that would have to be not the subject matter, because the subject matter of computer science started as, like, largely it was females.
Right, absolutely.
And then, they flipped it. They took it away.
Yeah. About the same time that the pay increased from being deemed menial to, men are doing it. Must be difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I can feel the levels of frustration combined in the room just rising massively.
Well, you're actually talking to 4 women, and Jay, but 4 women who work in the ops space, which is a lot of times considered women's work. Anyways, it's paid a lot less. And computer science is a great example of, like, when it switches, the pay changes.
Yep.
The same happens in, like, the medical field. Nursing used to be mostly women. Now that there are more men, pay is going up. But yes, I would say you hit a...
And I believe the same happens in reverse. When there are things that are primarily men and then women start joining the ranks, then the pay comes down.
Yep.
I just wanted to ask, what opened your eyes in the beginning that this was even a problem and something that you wanted to focus on and became very passionate about? Because there are so many people out there that say, this isn't a problem. You just need to be smarter and you just need to do things that the men are doing. And,
right.
Bootstraps. And,
right. So I was never someone in that position. I was aware that there was a problem, and I went to all the appropriate diversity courses in Google and interviewing appropriately, but that's not the same as having your eyes opened. So around, I think it was August 2015, I think, I was reading the Geek Feminist Wikia. I have no idea how I landed on that. It must have been from a tweet or something. But I sort of went from page to page. There's no way that you could read the whole of it because it's just enormous. But I went from page to page and thought, this is something I should find out more about and take seriously, and ordered a bunch of books online. I certainly ordered Everybody Should Be a Feminist, Bell Hooks, and Laura Bates' Everyday Sexism. And I think another couple, but I can't remember exactly what, sort of consumed those and then got into some other books. I would strongly recommend Emma O'Toole's Girls Will Be Girls about gender performativity. Fantastic. And sort of became more interested in general. So this is feminism in general rather than specifically applied to the tech space. But obviously the tech space sort of has its own way of taking on things. And then around March the following year, the Women's Equality Party in the UK was formed by Catherine Mayer, sort of as founder, and joined by Sophie Walker and Sandy Toksvig. And around, I think it was the end of August that year, I joined the party. So obviously that sort of increases your involvement and things. So there's always been this mixture of general interest in equality, and I'm very keen on the Women's Equality Party sort of motto or byline, whatever you call it, is because equality is better for everyone. And I firmly, firmly believe that. I think men who are resisting equality by saying, oh, they'll take our jobs away, there are aspects where you are trying to split a pie more evenly, but there are so, so many more aspects where the pie just gets bigger and everyone benefits. You know, I don't think there are many men who would say, no, I'm perfectly fine with my relationship with my children. I don't particularly want to know them any better. You know, everyone wants to have a better relationship with their children or with their spouse, etc. So things like shared parenting, more equal parenting, just work for everyone. And then there's the tech space where there are very specific issues, whether that's in terms of harassment, whether it's in terms of unequal pay, whether it's in terms of unequal hiring, the fall-off rate, etc., etc. So that's the story of sort of how they've kind of gone hand in hand for me.
Oh, that's awesome. It seems like it's kind of rare, especially in this space, someone who gets it and is also just so outspoken about getting it in hopes of making other people get it. So it's wonderful.
One of the things I realized early on is I don't really get it. I get it to some extent, and I keep getting it a bit more. And one of the blog posts that I wrote, I tweeted about, and Emo O'Toole, who I mentioned before, read the post and then was saying, wow, that's awful in these ways. And she very compassionately wrote a sort of 13-tweet thread saying what I'd done wrong in, you know, how I phrased things and how I'd approached the subject. And I was immensely grateful for that because it was opening my eyes again, and it's all layers and building. But really, not just what I learned in terms of, yeah, that was a bad way of thinking about things, but the fact that she took the time and was not, you're an awful man. It was, right, this is how you can improve. And as I say, it was with compassion, which I was immensely grateful for. Yeah, it's cool.
So what advice would you have for other people who are trying to do the work and not getting defensive? So she gave you the compassionate feedback, mm-hmm. and you could have gotten really defensive and been like, oh, I was trying and this is unhelpful. And
which was my first reaction.
Yeah. And I... So how did you like bust through that and say, okay, and take the criticism to heart instead of just getting really upset and saying, well, this is just not something I'm going to deal with?
I kept my fingers away from the keyboard.
Don't hit enter.
It was partly helpful that when she was giving the feedback, I was in the park with my kids. So I wasn't near an actual keyboard. It would have had to be by the phone. And that extra bit of friction helped me not reply or just reply saying thank you. But yes, it's so easy to think that whatever you think in the spur of the moment is the right thing to say. And it almost never is. So just taking some time, if you're going to be defensive a day later because you've thought through and really tried to take on board all the feedback, and maybe you feel some of it's appropriate and some of it wasn't, then fine. And one of the points that Emma was making at the time was, you know, feminism is quite open to criticism, but it needs to be from a better place than I was coming from. You know what I mean? A more honest and less patronizing place than I was coming from at the time. So yeah, open engagement, but do take the time to think first. And particularly if you're engaging in a topic where you're speaking from ignorance, which I clearly am, you know, I am not a woman, I don't know what it's like to be a woman, I never will, then listening to other people first, having bigger ears than a mouth, is a good thing.
Actually, I have a question related to that, thinking specifically about not just tech, but software. I had the pleasure of seeing both you and Joel speak at Web Summit in Lisbon last November. Joel first spoke about the massive impact that software has on people in society and the need for software developers to build things responsibly so that community will get better and not worse. He kind of argued recently it's gotten worse because of software. And then you followed him, and you spoke a bit about in order for software to work for everyone, there's a need for everyone to be involved in writing software. Software developers wield great power, but if they're all straight white men, the software is only going to serve and solve the problems of straight white men, which will systematically hold women back and propel men forward. Mm-hmm. So when you are writing software, either in your personal work or at work, what do you do to try to make sure that you're also building products and writing code that will serve women and people who are not like you?
Well, probably not enough.
Okay.
So I write class libraries for people to interact with Google Cloud Platform from C#. I guess the most obvious thing that probably would serve all software engineers or anyone who writes consumer documentation where consumers can be other software engineers. So my customers are other software engineers. Little things like when you're writing the documentation, think about how it would sound to someone for whom English is not first language, which can be really difficult for technical things. And it's something that I'm not actually very good at. I've tried writing a beginner's book for C#, and it's temporarily on hold, where temporarily maybe for many, many years, because my style of writing tends to be very technical and detailed. And that doesn't lend itself to people with English as a second, third, you know, whatever language. And I only speak English. I'm in awe of everyone who's coming to Stack Overflow or wherever it is with English not as their main language and trying to interact with people. And whether that's going through a sort of layer of translation in their head, I don't know. But it really is up to all of us to try to bear that in mind. I don't know how gender would interact in terms of my product particularly. I do try to, little things like when I give an example of a developer, if I'm not saying you can do this, I would try to be gender neutral in terms of referring to potential developers. I know some people sort of like to alternate between he and she, but I tend to just use the singular they. And I've been astounded at how, not necessarily that example, but how similar examples like science textbooks, the difference in response from girls doing science at school, if they have science textbooks with pictures of women scientists as well as men, then boys don't do any worse and girls do better. This whole idea of, you know, you can only be what you can see, just little psychological cues. So some people would say, oh, it's being petty, and you know, if someone's going to be put off because you refer to he for the software developer, then they deserve all they get. No, it's
so systematic,
cues.
Though.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not just like, you know, you can read it once, but if you're reading it for all of your science education.
Exactly. And it's where you've got research that backs that up. There are examples of girls taking a maths test at sort of age 5, and you have two groups. One group, before they take the maths test, colors in a landscape picture, and another group colors in a picture with a girl holding a doll. Okay? That should make no difference to how good you are at maths, right? But no, the group that has colored in a picture of a girl holding a doll, they're reminded that they're girls and girls aren't good at maths, and they do significantly worse. These little cues and trying to take those cues seriously and accept the science. It's amazing how computer scientists and software engineers are all for the data unless the data goes against what they feel naturally because of the systematic, the things we've all learned culturally for however many years. Yeah, so believe the science, that whether you call it prejudice, discrimination,
bias,
just bias, anything that screws people's chances completely unnecessarily, there's no benefit. Yeah, so think about how that kind of thing, how the small cues can apply to your product. As I say, I try to in documentation, but it's probably a good thing for me to take away and think about.
Are there any women on your team on this project?
There is now.
Okay.
We have one woman as of this week. I think she started officially in our team on Monday.
All right. Well, then, you know, in 6 months, report back if she had opinions that things were done.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Piggybacking on her question, these conferences, how do you determine the criteria for which conferences?
Right. So got a bit of flack for this, but I posted on my coding blog saying, if I'm going to be a feminist and believe that there should be more representation at conferences, then I need to take a stand when it comes to choosing which conferences I do attend. I'm in an incredibly fortunate position for whatever reason that I am asked to speak at places. And now I have, it's sort of a checklist. I would love to say it's as scientific as, you know, I apply various criteria and give a score, but it's really, I look at the list of speakers that have already been announced for the conference, if it's at that stage, or look at previous years. And there are definite red flags if there are sort of 20 speakers of whom one is a woman or no women at all. And ideally, I've become, through feminism, I've become more conscious of racial bias as well and other forms of bias, but I'm significantly less developed in my thinking about those. So while I would certainly welcome being a more generally diverse set of speakers, I don't think I have the awareness of different locations and racial mix and things yet. So I like to see a diverse set of speakers. I don't want to be on panels. If it's one person interviewing two people, if all three of those are men, then that sort of feels plausible. If it gets to the stage of having four people on stage and they're all men, then I start to shy away from that a bit more and say, you know, can't we try to do better? It's not like there aren't perfectly capable women with fantastically interesting viewpoints that I would like to hear from and be part of a panel in that respect. And you know, people have said, it's really not up to you to set this kind of thing, but I view it as it's my choice as to which conferences I'll accept invitations to.
I've actually seen on Twitter like a Bechdel test for tech conferences that there need to be at least two women in the same panel. They're not talking about the fact that they're women.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Share with our audience. What's the Bechdel test in movies?
Oh, boy. My film history degree being called into.
I know about this because Alison Bechdel went to Oberlin.
Hey. Oh.
So the Bechdel test is from a comic called Dykes to Watch Out For by Alison Bechdel that in the comic they're walking and saying like, oh, do you want to see a movie? And then the other woman is like, well, I only see movies if they fit a specific criteria. There have to be two women
who have names,
who talk to each other at some point during the movie, not about men. And then the other woman says, oh, you must not see that many movies or something like that. But it's a good test, not necessarily for whether or not a movie is feminist or something, but it is good. And variations of it are definitely good for representation, sort of being able to gauge whether or not something is representative.
And 538 recently had, well, a few months ago now, had an article about different proposed sort of sequels to the Bechdel test that were, as well as what's going on screen, what's going on in terms of production and writing and directing with various different women in film proposing new tests.
Yeah.
It's shocking how few passed, even back when it was originally proposed. And I would like to think that things have got better, but it's still pretty poor.
So you've been an outspoken feminist for a while now, and it's been on your coding blog, and you talk about it at conferences. What sort of backlash have you gotten, if any? I'm guessing you probably have, from the community, especially the programming community. And how have you dealt with that, and what sort of backlashes have you gotten?
So much less backlash than I would have got saying exactly the same things if I'd been a woman, to start with.
Nice.
On the internet, you know, whatever you say, someone will disagree with. But it seems that if you're a woman, you can get rape threats and death threats and doxing and all kinds of things. And I certainly haven't had anything like that. People either questioning my masculinity, which raises the question about what they think is masculinity. And I remember when there was International Men's Day back in November,
excuse
I think it is.
Me?
Yeah, yeah.
Thank goodness we're getting a day. Right. It's high time.
It's about time, huh?
Yeah.
So the Women's Equality Party had a feature on International Men's Day, and I was delighted to be part of that. So, you know, my photo was there and a couple of paragraphs about why I support the Women's Equality Party. And when our leader, Sophie Walker, tweeted about that, there were replies saying, oh, yes, I bet these are all soy men. Which,
what men? Soy?
Soy, yeah. Men. As in, you know, not fed with real milk. I don't know. It's
or,
sort of,
or maybe they don't eat meat or something?
No, because it's horrible. It's because if you drink a lot of soy, soy can affect your hormones.
It has a lot of estrogen in it.
Oh.
Yeah, okay. So I actually knew that.
It's a slur for like someone being more feminine, and it's just
it's a
just
biochemical insult? That
yeah,
is,
okay. It is.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there was that kind of thing. It's very low level. I did have recently my blog post about why aren't more men feminists. That blog post had more traffic just in the last few weeks from some men who were giving detailed arguments about why I was completely wrong. And of course, the world isn't at all biased against women. They're just moaning.
Because of course they would know.
Right. And you know, signing off with MTGOW, men going their own way.
Let's see how far they get.
So presumably the blog post had been shared on some site that they were all frequenting.
That's a big moment right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I hope it's a sort of backlash that's a last dying gasp of division. I'm hoping that about many things at the moment. But yeah, ultimately, if people are expressing that kind of opinion and expressing it in that way and not actually physically threatening me, then I don't really care much because they're not expressing themselves in a way that suggests that I should be paying attention to them. You know, if there are death threats and whatever, I'd pay a different kind of attention. If people come back with articulate arguments, then very happy to engage on that front. And I've been aware of arguments within feminism that I would never have been aware of a few years ago around TERFs and SWERFs.
Yeah.
So trans exclusionary radical feminists and sex worker exclusionary radical feminists. And I had never heard of these groups at all before. And I feel unqualified to engage in any kind of debate on that front. But fortunately, there are many other more qualified people doing so. But yeah, I'm in the fortunate position where it is just low-level noise that I can pretty much just ignore.
It's interesting that a lot of anti-feminists, they think that their argument is the first time we've ever heard it.
Right.
So it's like, okay, this is definitely something new, dude, definitely.
Yeah. And I found it interesting when you say I'm an outspoken feminist. I was thinking, that sounds, there's a connotation of speaking too much, but I would like to think of it, turning it around as someone who is speaking out.
To be clear, I was not meaning it as in like being at all, like saying too much. It's just that a lot of people that I know, at least, they like to say that they're feminists. And I have conversations with them because I don't see them acting in a way that would change people's minds, like with some sort of jokes. If somebody makes jokes about women, or I don't see, like in their own minds, they're not going to think this way. But what are they doing outwardly to help?
Right. Exactly. There's an organization that I'm tangentially associated with called Restored Relationships in the UK. It's a really interesting organization asking both the church and men to be countering domestic violence against women. And they are part of a group with a campaign called First Man Standing. So would you be the person to stand up to your friends, which is a real challenge if your friends are telling sexist jokes, are you going to be the person to stand up and say, no, that's not okay? And it is a challenge, and people will feel, you know, the whole soy man thing, people might feel that there's a risk. And I would just say that the risk to any man standing up for women, and we can come to knights versus allies later on maybe, but standing up where they are present and able to do so, that risk is so much less than the risk that other women face every day, whether they're, you know, just living their lives or speaking up and being doxxed for it or whatever. The thing about standing up for reminds me of a talk that a woman called Rhonda Bergman gave in Codemash, and she referred to knights versus allies, where a knight really isn't what we need. We don't need people who are sort of going to bat and rescuing the princess from a particular situation. Like, no, that's what a knight does. And there are situations which call for intervention sensitively, but what's more important are allies who are fighting against the systematic discrimination and trying to change the system from within. And I find that a challenging thing to try to place myself in. What am I actually doing as an ally? Or am I standing up and pretending to be a knight? Yeah, I find it difficult.
I think one of the more interesting things for me, having met you, just because I've worked here for the amount of time that I've worked here, so John Skeet as like the Chuck Norris sort of ethos has been something that I've been aware of for a long time. But just the amount of enthusiasm, I guess it's like, oh, I read some books and then yeah, now we're doing it, and I'm going to talk about it, and I'm going to, you know, tweet about it, and I'm going to be engaged with it. And it's like you're approaching your journey in feminism similarly to the other stuff that you seem to get really excited about, like Stack Overflow. You know, it's this wealth of knowledge. So I feel like that's cool, having met you, how enthusiastic you are about learning more, that this is something that's important to you and something that you're aware of, you know, where you still have more to learn. And
it's so much more to learn.
Yeah. I just, that part to me is cool, that you can sort of be aware of all of those things at the same time and just really enthusiastic about it, instead of something where it's like you're nervous. I think people sort of get nervous to talk about it sometimes.
I'm definitely not nervous on talking, but translating it into action is where it's going
to
be.
So people are so worried about messing up. And I try to talk to people about, like, you're going to mess up. I'm going to mess up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm even in my own journey of learning about, like, intersexual feminism, and, like, I'm a feminist, but I'm also white. And so learning about, like, there's so much more that goes on in the Black community, the trans community, just all of that. Like, I'm also going to mess up, but it doesn't mean that you don't learn about it and still keep trying to do the work.
Yeah.
So what would you say about people that are afraid of messing up?
I would point them at, I'll find a link for you later on. There was a checklist for male allies, and the 10th point is exactly, you know, you will screw up. Be aware that you're going to, and when you do, don't get defensive and say, right, well, that's the last time I'm trying to help. Be aware that you will screw up, and we know that you're trying to do the right thing, but be aware that when you do screw up, if you offend someone, you being sorry doesn't mean that they're not offended. So it doesn't erase screwing up. Definitely be sorry, but you have to go past that yourself. Basically, this woman puts it much better than I can. So if I just link to that later on,
I'll put it in the blog post.
I'm feeling such an incredible metaphor for programmers and finding bugs, you know, like using Stack Overflow to fix those bugs, and you try and you try and you try again. And it's the same thing, you know, with this, with life. And
yeah, yeah. I can really feel for people who do try to do the right thing. And if their first experience, maybe I've just been lucky in the ways I've screwed up. I have been very compassionately corrected, and maybe other people have had worse experiences. But so I can feel for people who give up immediately. But one of the things that this woman says in this list is partly you can't give up because the reason you were trying to start with is your eyes have been opened and you can't shut them anymore. You know, once you start seeing the discrimination in the system, it's really hard to just pretend it's not there anymore. So you get to either live with knowing that you're not trying to do anything about a system that sucks, or you die and say that you'll do better next time.
Casey has a great way that she talks about this.
So I think of some of this work as, you know, you're looking through different lenses of things all the time. I guess, like, when you're a software developer, you know, what are you optimizing for? So you look at, like, different ways of how you're optimizing for the program or something. So if I'm trying to optimize for the world that I want to see, how can you look through the lens of inclusion? How can you look through the lens of feminism and intersectional feminism and all of that stuff more often? And then how do you sort of give other people the lens so that they can look at it?
She often says, like, our developers have to look at Stack Overflow, their D&I goggles. You gotta put the goggles on.
Right. Their inclusion glasses. Yeah. Or, you know, just so that at first it's like a conscious action, and then eventually you're sort of wearing them kind of all the time.
Right.
And
challenging each other to do that. So as Cassie was asking me earlier, you know, what are you doing in your product? Like, oh, I haven't thought about that. I really need to think about that. So yeah.
Well, in a big picture too, something Joel has talked about a lot is that what Facebook did for a really long time is they just optimized for people to stay on Facebook. The algorithm was just about keeping you there, which actually led to some nasty outcomes and some pretty big divisions of, you know, often left versus right politically. And with Stack Overflow, it's like, what is it we're going to optimize for that gets to the best future for everyone?
Money. We want all the money.
Well, that brings up a good question. Like, do you have any advice for Stack Overflow to help us with the gender parity of our users? I know that's a huge question, but it's something that's something that we definitely have been working on. It's something that we want to make better for everyone.
I think it comes back to the topic that's being discussed almost ad nauseum, but needs to keep being discussed around niceness and making Stack Overflow a positive experience for as many people as possible.
Yeah.
Because I would imagine, and this is only imagining, that if you're a junior woman developer, and maybe you're already nervous, maybe you've already got imposter syndrome, and maybe the guys at work are being less friendly than they might be, then imagine if Stack Overflow is the place that you can go to and always feel welcome and be actively welcome. To go on to a slightly different side of diversity, my wife and I and our three kids went to Pride London 4 years ago now.
You marched, right? I remember.
We marched.
The parade. I remember seeing it.
We marched as part of the Google sort of parade, and we checked beforehand that straight allies were welcome, and boy, were we welcome. We had people just came and hugged Holly and said, thank you so much for coming. I have this sort of idea of a spectrum of welcomeness, and there's being not tolerated at all, to start with, is sort of at one obvious end. But then there's this idea of being tolerated that really isn't good enough. And I'm starting to view the term tolerance in actually a quite negative light, because that's saying, well, you're bad, but okay, we'll look past it for the moment.
There's an otherness in tolerance.
Exactly, exactly. Thank you for putting it better than I can. And then there's the sort of ambivalence, or even ambivalence is strictly not what I'm saying, but not caring at all. And then there's this place, this church service, this parade, this community, whatever it is better because you are here. Yeah. And that was the welcome that we received on that Pride parade. And I danced is the best way I can express how I felt. I just don't dance, but I felt so welcomed there that that made me dance. So how can we get Stack Overflow to being that place where people feel so welcome that it's more than a safe space, because safe is just can be an absence of harm. But if they feel genuinely embraced with open arms, I suspect that that would obviously help in general, but disproportionately help those who don't feel welcomed elsewhere.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think as we wrap this up, I think we don't have a lot of answers. We need to keep thinking about this and getting better. But I think one thing you touch on there is sometimes the best first step is just declaring what you want. Right. And being able to say out loud, like, it's not like, well, why shouldn't women feel just as welcome here? It's like,
right.
It's not an important question. The thing we're trying to communicate is it's important to us that women do feel welcome here.
Yeah.
And it's important to us that developers of color feel welcome here. It's important to us that whoever you are as a developer, you should feel welcome here. And we've got some weird rules, a little persnickety, but we want you. And like you said, you add to this community. And I think we got to keep thinking about ways to signal that, and we have to recognize some of the ways we're persnickety have a good reason, but they make everyone feel a little bit unwelcome.
Yeah.
And if you live that way in your life in a way that you and I don't experience day to day, it's that much worse.
And it's the sort of technically correct is the worst kind of correct.
My son is now 6, and I'd say he's taken to starting his sentences with technically, daddy. And I'm always like, that is the worst kind of correct every single time. Well, John, I want to thank you. I want to thank our regular guests and our special guests for sort of helping to lead such a, I think, really awesome conversation. I hope you will continue to sort of talk on the topic and be an inspiration, talking about being outspoken. I think of myself as someone who is a feminist. I am a feminist. I don't know why I said that so passively. I am a feminist.
Well, a lot of people are so afraid. A lot of men are so afraid to say it.
So that brings me to your homework for this week, dear listeners. If you don't already know, don't just Google John Skeet's blog, because you'll miss some of the good stuff. John Skeet has 3 blogs, because, you know, he's John Skeet, and one blog is not enough for him. But in addition to John's coding blog, which I think you may be familiar with, he has a faith blog. John also has a personal blog, and John's personal blog is in large part devoted to sort of his exploration of understanding other people's experience. And like you'll hear from John in person, I think one of the things I took away from it, I've taken a lot of specific things away. I think there's some really interesting perspectives. John would be super fast to point out that there are women writers and people of color writing on these topics who have vastly more experience than him, both from personal experience and also academically, who've spent more time. But what I'd say you'll find consistently in John's writing, and I really recommend you go check it out, is I think a humility and a curiosity. And I think John brings that to most things he does, but he is exploring as someone who does not have that experience, what the experience is without questioning or second guessing it. He's just trying to hear it and then translate it into what he can do. And I've found that really helpful in how I think about things. And I think some of you will too. And so if you're looking to learn a little more yourself, I cannot recommend his personal blog enough. It's been the center of conversations we had here and some diversity conversations at the company. And I found it sincerely inspirational in a lot of ways, John. So thank you.
Well, thank you. But it's only a gateway to people who actually know what they're talking about.
Yes. So John's blog is the gateway drug. You'll start with that. You'll find a new perspective on life. And that will help you on your path to ultimately smash the patriarchy correctly. I joke, but I want you to go check out blog.johnskeet.uk.
Not a joke.
That is not a joke. That is the actual URL. And with that, I want to thank you again, John. Thank you for being here. More importantly, thank you for all the help you've given people on the site.
My pleasure.
We joke about the numbers, but it makes a real difference in a lot of people's lives. We're proud to do our little part to contribute to it. But John gets highlighted because he is the biggest, the most visible, the highest rep user on the site. But Stack Overflow is a lot bigger than us. We know every day we meet people like John, and it's a lot bigger than John. There are literally hundreds of thousands of developers out there who have stopped what they were doing at work to help someone else do their work or help them with their project or just help them have fun with something that they wanted to build. And Stack Overflow is really powered by all those people. And I think it's a huge inspiration to us here. We talk a lot about what it means to work here. And you want to work with great people, I think. You want to have a culture where people feel like they're appreciated and they're doing something that matters. And having a mission like ours is really built entirely on the fact that we can facilitate all those people who do that. So thanks to all of you out there. And with that, I'm afraid you've gone, and maybe this week you haven't wasted another hour of your life listening to the Stack Overflow podcast, number 123, recorded Thursday, February 15th, 2018, at Stack Overflow headquarters in New York City. This podcast has been brought to you by the World Curling Association. You can laugh all you want, but it's not any dumber than trying to hit a sphere with a stick so you can run around in a square. It's just not. Our audio engineer is Carlos Hernandez. Audio editor is David Greenlee. Technology concierge is Michael Rosa. Our producer is Jess Pardue. And on behalf of Ilana Yatsaki, Jess Pardue, Casey Ashenhurst, Cassie Montrose, and a man with more humility than seems possible, given what an amazing human being he is, John Skeet, I'm your host, Jay Hanlon. Please go check out John's blog. Have a great week, everybody.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
Give me a million reasons. Give me a million reasons. Giving me a million reasons. About a million reasons. Give me a million reasons. Give me a million reasons. Giving me a million reasons. Everybody.
Also, I checked. We don't have a theater stack exchange. Or Broadway or plays. I tried those three words. If there are other
or
words.
Or drama.
Drama. I didn't check drama. Jay, is there a drama?
We don't have drama.
We do. Oh, Jay, we have drama.
So we did Aristophanes' Birds in Greek. About half the cast knew ancient Greek and were doing classics, and half of the cast didn't. And I'd never done ancient Greek and somehow got one of the lead roles and had to learn like 500 lines entirely phonetically.
Like ABBA.
Wow.
Right?
Like ABBA, they didn't speak any English when they recorded their first couple albums.
Oh, wow.
Apparently.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they were just learning the sounds and they sang them really well. And it was awesome. I bet you were awesome, like ABBA.
I think I was genuinely not very good, to be honest. But anyway, Holly was in the chorus during the run in Cambridge. And then we took it over to Greece at the start of the following academic year. And yes, one somewhat drunk night in Athens, Holly and I got together. And the next day, I appeared with a ring of love bites around my neck that then had to be sort of covered with foundation during the play and stuff.
That's adorable. Also, I love that you call them love bites.
Oh, instead of hickeys? Yeah,
yes.
Hickey is more US thing. That's it. Yes, US-UK and gender situation.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. So I would say there's definitely still a problem.
At least they have a queen.